Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were devolving back. Oh, we weren't devolving. Our conversation was devolving back into one all about statistics, which everyone loves.
Well, that's just a heads up warning. But there's no formulas, but some concepts. And right. But you did some cool work. Was it MATLAB that you ran these two simulations on?
Yeah. So for some of my courses, I like having some really illustrative animations and graphics and things like that. And so, the first one we just looked at was where we looked how we had 30 data points and we created a PDF or a density curve that sort of represents the likelihood of those data points having particular values. Probably the most well-known density curve or PDF is the bell curve. And with the magic of computers and maths and numbers, we're able to put confidence bounds on the computer's best guess of this density curve based on a number of data points.
And it was a, you know, it looked like roughly a bell curve and then fat. It kind of was a fuzzy fat line going over this curve.
Big fat line, looked like a bell curve. And obviously it was a big and fat line, which represents uncertainty because we only had a relatively small number of data points and the animation.
Well, that's the, you know, you said 30 data points and you know, and many of us, and myself included, is if you get 30, you're gold. You know, you got more, you know, because there are folks that get two data points and want to fit a curve to it. And here with 30, it illustrated that, yeah, it's still pretty vague as to where the mean really is and where how's the shape of this thing. Is it skewed or not skewed? Is it, you know, there's still a lot of uncertainty on that.
Right. And one, you can obviously get more data to reduce that uncertainty, or you can make your thing really reliable, really exceed the requirements so that any uncertainty is caught up in the fact that, hey, we're so far above it, doesn't matter. But it, at least for the statistical part of this, like the principle was illustrating, it just showed that, hey, you can have what we might think is quite a few data points, but that 90% confidence bound, which or that big fat line, which we sort of draw to represent that that lack of confidence, is quite fat. But the next part of this animation was a video where we simulated dropping lots of balls, which in each ball represented one more data point. As we went from 30 data points to 1,000 data points, Fred, as we can see, that line stops being fat. That line of best fit stops being a big fat region of, well, I don't know, to a much more concentrated, it genuinely does look like a line of best fit with a very tight confidence region around it. And it just goes, it just really, I think it nicely illustrates how much additional information data can give you when you're doing statistical analysis.
Well, I remember back in regression analysis classes, it was, you know, we did one confidence around the best fit. You know, we're trying to decide which model to use and we're looking at best fit. But sometimes, like a Weibull distribution, if you want to look at the confidence around your parameters, because you want to know, is it, you know, is it, what could the beta value be, or what is the characteristic life? What's the range on those particular parameters? And they even have more uncertainty around them. To get a tight confidence around a beta value, for example, to say, yeah, it really is 2.0 plus or minus, you know, point a tenth. If you need to be that accurate, you needed thousands and thousands of points of data to fit this thing. And it struck me as that there's two levels to this uncertainty. One is just the curve itself, the model in its, like the PDF or CDF type model, that curve. And then there's the parameters themselves. And so it really makes it a huge difference.
Right. And I think on that model, let's have a look at this one right here. And this one is exactly the same thing we looked at. It's exactly the same set of data, I should say. But instead of assuming a model which gives us the bell curve, and we should tell our listeners who don't have the ability to see these graphs through our voices. But the data, that random data we were looking at, was data which was clearly centered around a mean, or clustered around a central value. And that tells us that the density curve will likely have a bell shape, because a bell shape represents that sort of clustering around a central value. And of course, we all know that in reliability engineering, if you see a bell curve describe time to failure, then whatever it is we're looking at is wearing out. And so, Fred, if you look at this chart over here, we have the same data clustering around a central value. So we know if this data comes from time to failure of a system, that system was wearing out. But instead, we've assumed your personal favorite model, which is the exponential distribution, which is the world's simplest distribution. It assumes it only requires one parameter, which is the MTBF, and because the failure rate is constant, never changes. It's one product that's 100 years old is just as likely to fail as the brand new product. It's really simple. And when we do the same thing, we obviously start at the start, have 30 data points, and in the PDF curve with our exponential model is still pretty fat, but as we add all these additional data points, well, this clearly incorrect line of so-called best fit gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter.
Yeah, no, it looks great, you know, and you get a real tight confidence on your CDF or PDF drawing, and you say, "Oh, we got tight confidence, must be a good fit." It's not the same as a goodness of fit evaluation. It's just right. That you got an MTBF with a tight, you know, or the curve plots, and then the confidence bounds around them are tight. That it strikes me as, and I learned that a long time ago, is the tightness of the confidence is, you could artificially change that by just saying, well, I want a 60% confidence. Now they look great. Right. You know, they look great, but it doesn't mean anything.
It also goes to show that you can really manipulate the scenario to get the outcome you were hoping for.
Yeah. I think that's part of the issue, though, is that, I mean, one thing that you're illustrating is that you need to pay attention to which model you're selecting and have a rational reason for it and some evidence for it. But the second part is that the confidence in and of itself, in my mind, sure, it looks better with more data. And it's part of the reason we often say, hey, we need more samples, we need more data, and the argument for that. But it's where I find people trip up is they say, we want 90% confidence. Well, why do you want 90% confidence? Well, it's in all the textbooks, right? Well, is that sufficient for you to distinguish this is good or not good? Is this crossing a threshold? We want to be this reliable with 90% confidence. And they said, do you realize that means that the lower confidence has to be above your target where you need it to be? It's like filling a bottle. If you want to be 90% confident it's got exactly 1 liter or more in it, then that lower bound has got to be above 1 liter. And they're like, oh, I didn't know it meant that. And so what happens if I go to 95% confidence? Because I really want it to be right. And he says, well, then you need to put more than 1 liter in it. Right. So that, because the actual amount doesn't change. The data that you're running in the simulation is not changing. But the confidence can change by just changing from 90 to 95 or 90 to 60 or 90. I've seen one person put 40% confidence on it. So this curve represents that you're 60% wrong. Is that what you're yes. saying to me?
Well, I mean, the filling the container up with water is a really good analogy, because if you're using your eyeball to work out how much water should be in there, of course, you'll need to err on the side of caution, so mm-hmm. to speak, and probably end up on average having 1.2 liters in that container, because we are not naturally good at being able to measure the volume of a liquid just using our eyes. Obviously, if you get do it as your day job, you probably get better over time.
Well, if the liter, if it only fit, you know, if you fill it to the brim and it overflows and it's exactly 1 liter, then that's easier. But if it's filled to the shoulder and the shoulder's sloped and it's thick glass and give or take a little bit, you may be under or over a liter. Yeah. We're bad at doing that.
But in reliability, you don't have that perfect liter sized container. We have a bucket, and we have to get a liter of water into a bucket. And one way of doing that is just making sure, all right, well, I'm going to, and don't forget, water's not free. I mean, in most cases, we treat water as if it's free, but in this scenario, water's expensive. So if you're not, if you're using your eyeballs, then you need to err on the side of caution, maybe put, end up putting, risk putting 1.5 liters in there to make sure you've got 1 liter in there. Or you could invest in perhaps a really expensive, going back to the reliability testing analogy, really expensive set of scales or flow meter or something to make sure that you put exactly 1 liter in there. But that's in reliability and engineering, that's analogous, especially if you're doing demonstration testing, to doing a lot more testing or testing a lot more samples. So, but I think for me, the key message or the key thing that that I get from these little animations, and to be honest, I wasn't 100% sure what I was going to expect. I wasn't 100% sure what was going to happen when I used knowingly used an incorrect model to describe or to be part of data analysis. It just goes to show that you can be increasingly certain that your incorrectly selected model is correct if you get more data. The exponential distribution we use, which I know, again, is one of your personal favorites, as we get more and more data, and the data is clearly from another process, which is not described by the exponential distribution, but when we assume the exponential distribution is true, or we assume an incorrect model is true, at the end of the day, each data point still represents more and more information. So in effect, we're forcing a computer who we are telling that there is no chance it is any other model besides the one we've just given you. That computer will tell us that it is increasingly confident that this incorrect model is now has this parameter or has this shape. And I often try and explain models as little chunks of information. If we had all the data in the world, we wouldn't use models because we wouldn't need to.
Right.
We could use a non-parametric approach, or we just fatigue charts are, I think, a really good example where we just test the fatigue properties of steel in laboratories across the world so many times that we can just put thousands of data points onto a chart and say, okay, that's going to be the fatigue characteristics of 1050 steel or 1045 steel. And that's a perfectly valid approach.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to put any models in there. We just put those thousands of data points onto a piece of paper. They will tell us the confidence bounds, and off we go. And those are incredibly powerful non-parametric models. We didn't bring any pre-existing information into that generation of that chart. But as you alluded to, Fred, sometimes we think 30 data points is awesome. And that doesn't give us a lot of information. If you've got 30 data points and you're interested in knowing when the first 5% of your things are going to fail, well, 5% of 30 is 1.5 data points. So you've got 1.5 data points in your data set, which might be the only data points which you base a decision on what your warranty reliability will be for a product where you're hoping to sell hundreds of thousands of them later on. It just doesn't quite work like that.
Well, no, I don't think – I think you oversimplified how, you know, 1.5 pieces of information for it, because the other 28.5 contribute to it. They're not as useful, but the ones out near the mean do contribute to your estimate at the tail. Right, because they start defining what's the slope of this thing, how is it skewed, or whatever. But the more data you have at the tail, the better your estimate is at that tail, at that 5th percentile. That to me is obvious. But it's not that you discount or ignore the data, the other 28 points. I think they still contribute, but it's a diminishing amount that they contribute out to. So it may be 2.5 points of information where it's out there out of 30 points.
I don't know. I mean the biggest, I'm not sure if I'm entirely on board with that, because I concur that the other 28 data points do contribute. But the reality is that when you're trying to turn data points into estimates of, for example, the 5th percentile, regardless of how many other data points, if you have
Oh yeah, if there's an outlier or it's an odd point that, but it's on the tail, it'll really change that estimate at that tail.
And is that that's what you mean? Yeah, because that's part of it. There's so many different parts to this.
Mm-hmm.
But the suffice to say, 30 data points would make me nervous if that was the only information I had to advise a company about what a warranty period should be if they are aiming for a 5% warranty failure rate.
Don't worry about it. Most warranty settings are usually ignored from reliability professionals anyway. The finance team goes, well, we only have $20, so that's what we're going to base it on that.
That's next week's podcast, Fred. Oh, we're statisticians in today's podcast. We're not talking about real world warranty. Okay.
Yeah.
No, I do agree, but I think that the point I'm trying to make is that when we have what seems like a relatively small amount of data, which means we have a relatively small amount of information.
Yep.
We as human beings like models. We like putting bell curves or whatever curve because that model represents information. And if we can fit a model with a number of data points, what we've done is just by assuming that model is true, we have just thrown a bucket load of information to our data analysis machine. There's no way knowing you could create those fatigue SN curves, Fred. Hopefully you agree with this, with 30 data points.
Well, you can, but they're not very good.
All right. Looking forward to you agreeing with one thing I say.
No, one of the things I learned a long time ago is that the difference between the Weibull and the log normal for, you know, is that they're very, very similar. And if I remember right, one of them is a little fatter tailed than the other one. It just in general is the nature of that distribution. But in order to statistically distinguish between the two of them, you needed a lot of data. And it was, and that's just the regression analysis to know which is the appropriate model based on that particular data set, because the uncertainty is enough of a with like 30 data points. Statistically, you can pretty much never distinguish between those two distributions for that set of data. It just the parameter uncertainty and the distribution uncertainty is enough that it's just there. You can't tell, but if you add lots and lots of data, you can get to it.
But just to be clear, you're talking about the family of Weibull distributions which mimic the log normal, because there's lots of Weibull distributions which are
But if I go into a data analysis package and I have 30 data points and I suspect it's a wear out mechanism or it's mm-hmm. a time to failure distribution, so I almost by default I just plot a Weibull curve and take a look at it, see what it is. But if I suspect it might be a log normal distribution because of some mm-hmm. physical phenomena or some other evidence or something else, in order to say clearly in statistical terms, this is a log normal versus a Weibull, it's folly with only 30 points. It's just, there's not enough separation there. But it's different than looking at confidence intervals, right? What you're illustrating here, when you have a bell-shaped curve, it could be a normal or a Weibull or even a log normal that would appropriately model that thing. But when you just assume it's an exponential, the confidence then with lots more data says, well, it fits that just fine. But that's not an appropriate judgment of is it a good fit or not, the confidence. Mm-hmm. Same with hypothesis testing. If I get lots and lots of data points, for a fixed percent of confidence, it'll get narrower and narrower. It'll get smaller. It's just because I have more data. It doesn't mean that I have the right model. I shouldn't be looking at the mean after all. Maybe what's important for this decision is the change in variance. This model this algorithm looking at the difference in the means is meaningless. But if I assume that's what's important, then I'm going to get a wrong answer. I'll get a number, I'll get an answer, but I'll be wrong.
Yeah. I was watching a documentary on a serial killer. There's plenty of serial killer documentaries.
Is this a warning that you're trying to convey here? Picking up tips or something?
I'm guessing you're wondering where I'm going to be ending up with this little trajectory, but just bear with me. It was for a serial killer in the United Kingdom, and they were hunting this guy down. And then what ended up happening was a hoaxer sent in a tape claiming to be the serial killer, and the powers that be and the police task force bought it hook, line, and sinker. And the hoax tape, it was clearly put together by someone who had a certain accent in the United Kingdom. As many of us who've traveled to the United Kingdom know, you can almost work out which street you were born on in the United Kingdom based on your accent.
Yep.
And so this is what we call a Geordie accent. And so the whole task force focused on a small town. I think it was Sutherland, but it doesn't matter. But the point was is that they assumed that the serial killer spoke with this accent, and that set the whole hunt back for years. And it was actually the only reason they caught the serial killer, who was from Yorkshire, was essentially a fluke police stop where they interrupted an unfortunate further murder attempt. It was complete luck. This whole task force had been focusing their effort on completely on the wrong thing. And during this effort, they had shoe sizes this, and they were able to track down certain notes of money and things like that. So they were still decreasing their suspect pool because they were doing all this work based on the premise that this serial killer came from a particular town. So it almost felt like they were getting closer and closer and closer as they were ruling out suspects who were too tall, too short, too big of feet, too small of feet. The problem was every suspect had to have this accent that they heard on this tape.
And so they were in the wrong guy. Part of the country at that point. You know, they're
right.
Looking. That's that same joke where a guy loses his keys and he's over underneath his porch light looking for him. He goes, where did you think you dropped him? It was over there by the car, but there's the light's better over here.
That's right.
You know, but yeah, that's the hard part I find with regression analysis in general. Unless you do the due diligence to analyze your data, and either you've got great rationale or reasons to pick a particular model and it's justifiable with evidence or first principles or something like that. Well, I told you this before, as I showed the ReliaSoft distribution wizard, where it would go like through 8 or 10 different distributions with your data set and give you all these goodness of fit parameters and say, well, this one obviously is the best fit for you. And he called it evil. And it is because it erased the need for a person that's doing that analysis to actually think through, well, what's going on with my data and where's this data coming from and what would be a reasonable model to use, as opposed to a machine generated one using 3 disparate goodness of fit models that were weighted equally, independent of the nature of the data or where those goodness of fit models actually worked. And it would spit out an answer for you. And he called it right, because I've seen it in legal cases where somebody just every data set they had with the exact same failure mechanism for month after month, they would get a group of data and they would let the wizard pick a different distribution. So this month it's a gamma, and this month it's a Weibull, and this month it's a log normal. And what I was showing the lawyer was that those different distributions for what you're trying to run the calculation out to do will give you dramatically different answers depending on which distribution you use. And so let's understand what is a good fit and then go with that. And at that point, they were looking at confidence and all this and goodness of fit and everything else, but they weren't actually thinking and understanding their data. And that is where they got into big trouble.
It is a challenge because, again, if you assume your wrong model, again, without you even knowing it, you're just pouring a big bucket of information into your data analysis problem. Yep. And it could be misinformation. It could be
you're
a red
say
herring.
Ancient. Yeah. Oh, I thought you were going there.
No,
okay.
No. I'll respect the turf I'm on.
Right. But, now, if you're wondering about what we're talking about with that little one, you'll have to contact us offline and buy us a beer or something like that. That'll work.
Yeah.
You know, we should do that. We should put that in the show notes instead of instead of the, you know, buy me a cup of coffee, you know, the little tip jar kind of thing. We could have a tab at our local brewery and they could contribute to that.
This is about 10 podcast series just waiting to be made on that one.
I think the main point I take away from this is, you know, the, when we select a model, we're adding information into it. We're forcing it into a particular mold, essentially. And adding more data into the wrong mold will give you the wrong result. I think that's clear in these two animations. And to say, well, the confidence looks good, is not sufficient here to test your model.
It's worse than that, Fred, because you not only if you force the wrong model, if you get more and more data, you're going to be more and more convinced that the wrong mold is correct. That's the really toxic part of it.
That's right. And that's where I'm saying is confidence has a particular use in statistics, but it's not a good way to tell if you've got a good model. It's a piece of information, but it's not the tell. And if you're going just adding more data, of course, more data is better. In the right use of it, and modeling of it. That I think is the key thing here. And that's a whole different discussion for a graduate degree in regression analysis, is to really understand how to pick the right model. Most of us just use, it's a Weibull. We always use Weibull, or it's always an exponential. I actually had somebody tell me that once. Well, how do you know it's exponential? Well, we always assume it is.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of not a good logical construct, I think. I'm not sure what that circular logic, I think.
It is because it is.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, so you're going to post these little animations up on the show notes?
Yeah, we'll maybe try and turn them into little GIFs or something like that. Hopefully my serial killer documentary analogy.
That was clever. I like that. Yeah, cool. Kind of threw me off there for a little bit.
I knew that. That's one of the reasons I busted it out, is just to,
very clever,
to inspire some. Where is this guy going?
Yeah.
Where's that big red button that they have in radio stations?
That's right. Yeah, do 10-minute loop. I'm gonna have to put you in a 7-second delay or something here. That might make it tough to have a conversation. But so anyway, if you'd like to join this conversation, you got some questions about this, or you get a chance to go over to the Sendo site, or you can go to reliability.fm. It's our podcast network. And you can find the Speaking of Reliability. And this episode should be number 684, which you probably know because you're listening to it. You can find those show notes and take a look at it. But you can also leave us a comment on the show notes page. And there's a SpeakPipe widget on the sidebar now. And you can find another contact form and a way to get a hold of us that's actually easier to remember than a long URL. It's ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can find Chris and I and the other hosts over on LinkedIn or on our About pages at Ascendo. So there's plenty of ways you can join the conversation, and we would really like to hear from you. It's made so many of the episodes germane to what you're interested in, and that's a good way to go, I think. Mm-hmm. So with that, Chris, you're going to test this algorithm out on like 15 different distributions and see which confidence interval is the best for you, or is it a mute point?
I'm definitely not doing that. Because I did the analysis and the simulation, I do know what the true underlying distribution is.
The trick. It's just, you know, create data randomly from your favorite distribution, and then you know which model to use.
That's right. That only works when you're trying to create examples for courses in the real world.
Takes a lot of work. That's,
yeah, that's right. We're still working on trying to control how things fail. Yeah, exactly. we can't impose a distribution.
Exactly. All right, cool. Well, thanks, Chris. We'll talk to you later. And thanks for sharing those animations. They're pretty cool.
All right. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.